In his latest book, the Ethiopian American writer Dino Mengistu explores the nature of loneliness, violence, and love. Now, Mengistu is known for his novels about the immigrant experience, but this book, All Our Names, is something of a departure. Much of the story unfolds in Africa, and there are two narrators. One is a young man who flees violence and revolution to seek refuge in America. The other is a white woman who has never left the Midwest. NPR's Lynn Neary has this look.
Dino Mengistu says in the past, his novels have dealt with the rupture and sense of loss that accompanies migration. But in All Our Names, he wanted his characters' lives and the politics of the time to converge in unexpected ways.
I think part of it was this idea that we tend to think of the stories that happen in Africa as being so radically distinct from our narratives here in America. And I wanted to find ways of making those narratives rub up against one another. And I wanted to also write, I think, from the point of view of a distinctly American voice, because that's another part of my identity that oftentimes hasn't come through in my other two novels.
Mengistu's family moved to America when he was a toddler. He grew up in the Midwest, so it doesn't seem strange to him that his distinctly American voice took shape in the form of a white woman named Helen.
In many ways, I think Helen's voice was actually the easiest voice to write out of, not only because she arrived in the novel almost fully formed in my imagination, but because she was, you know, sort of a compilation of many women that I've met and known throughout my life. When we left Ethiopia, the first place that, and my first memories are of Peoria, Illinois. I've never known a social worker exactly like Helen, but I've known many good women like her.
Helen is the social worker assigned to help a young man named Isaac who has just arrived in America. A lonely woman who still lives at home with her mother, Helen falls in love and begins a passionate and secret relationship with him. It's the early 1970s, and the taboo against mixed-race couples is still powerful. They meet with open hostility when they go to eat in a local diner, and she fantasizes that it makes the relationship stronger.
The fact that we chose to sit there and linger when every part of me wanted to run was proof of the sacrifices we were willing to make. When we left the restaurant and were back in the car, he said to me, "Now you know. This is how they break you. Slowly. In pieces."
For most of the book, Isaac's past is a mystery to Helen. But gradually, the reader learns that he has left his real identity behind in Africa and entered this country with a name he borrowed from his best friend. The two young men met at a university in Uganda's capital, Kampala. Neither could afford to go to the school, but they hung around the campus, soaking up the energy of post-colonial Africa in the late 1960s when anything seemed possible.
They meet out of this sort of shared desire to make something of themselves in a sort of very basic way. And I think the process by which they both go about doing that is where their narratives begin to sort of diverge. You know, they both choose slightly different paths, and yet at the same time, they're intricately bound to each other. So that deep intimacy is, you know, put through this dramatic test of the war and the violence that follows it.
Isaac, the narrator, becomes dependent on his namesake, who provides him with both companionship and a sense of identity and purpose. At one point, they are separated, and he is bereft.
Every day following Isaac's absence, I was reminded that without him, I made an impact on no one. I was seen, and perhaps occasionally heard, strictly by strangers, and always in passing. I was a much poorer man for this than I had ever thought.
The government's failure to live up to student expectations for post-colonial Africa leads to anti-government rallies on campus. The real Isaac becomes a popular leader and is drawn into a violent insurgency, which both men get caught up in. Mengistu, who has written about conflicts in Africa as a journalist, says he wanted to use the novel to complicate the simplistic way that such conflicts are often reported.
You begin to see that conflict in a very different light. You begin to see it not as sort of an inevitable product of ethnicity or religion or whatever tropes we may have, but really as the story of two young men who want something better for themselves. And this war, this conflict becomes one way that they think they might be able to achieve that.
But, you know, the conflict, the revolution, it had a sort of random quality to me.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I have found as working as a journalist and specifically covering conflicts and trying to meet men who at some point in time are or were in the process of becoming their own sort of revolutionary-like figures, I often found that there was a total randomness to it, a randomness not only to how they came into power, but to their causes and the sort of logic of why they began the violence. You know, violence kind of unfolded without a logical necessity behind it. You know, there's an expression of frustration. And I think when you don't have any other means to express that frustration, violence quickly becomes the form.
But Mengistu says this is not a book about war, It's a book about love. He sees it as a series of portraits of love, a love born out of loneliness and need, complicated by war and politics. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Truth is stranger than fiction, but shouldn't fiction writers, of all people, know that? When Walter Kern, who's written best-selling novels, was just beginning to write fiction, he met a man who was a bold financier, an art collector, a fussy eccentric, a dog lover, and a Rockefeller. They became friends. But over the years, Walter Kern began to learn that the man who called himself Clark Rockefeller was none of that, not even a dog lover. He was a psychopath and a killer. How could the man who'd written insightful, best-selling novels that have become movies, including Up in the Air and Thumbsucker, not recognize the fraud right in front of his face? Was the imposter so compelling, or was the novelist, like a lot of other people drawn to the imposter, duped by his own desire to have an attachment to a famous name? Walter Kern's new book is Blood Will Out, The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. He joins us from Bozeman, Montana. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with the story of a dog.
Mm-hmm.
You were living in Montana. You were writing and ranching and thought you'd help out a crippled dog named Shelby and the woman to whom you were then married. So how did this connect with the faux Rockefeller?
It's 1998, the summer, and the Livingston Humane Society gets in a dog that has been run over and shot and is in a wheelchair because the back half of its body is paralyzed. They put it up for adoption on the internet because it's a fancy breed, a Gordon Setter. And a man from New York contacts them. His name is Clark Rockefeller. He'd very much like to adopt the dog, he says. He can give it a wonderful home. He has a cook for his other Gordon Setter. He serves four-course meals to it. He lives near Central Park and can take it for walks every day. The problem is how to get it there, because Clark Rockefeller doesn't drive, and his plane is in China with his wife that summer.
Ah.
The Humane Society comes to me and says, hey, Walter, you lived on the East Coast. You went to Princeton University. Maybe you can talk to this fancy character and figure out how to get him the dog. Long story short, I ended up driving him the dog in my Ford pickup from Montana, 2,000 miles to New York City.
And what was the man who called himself Clark Rockefeller like?
Well, I met him on the phone first. I asked him what he did, and he said, Walter, I'm a freelance central banker. Other things that came up during the phone call, the fact that he'd never tasted Coca-Cola, never eaten in a restaurant, got me to thinking, I, as a fiction writer, have to meet this guy. It would be professional malpractice if I didn't.
Now, you met him finally. He said he lived in the same apartment building as Tony Bennett, as a matter of fact. This struck you as a building where a rich person might live, but...
Well, you know, it was a block off of Central Park. He invited me up, and there was no furniture, no real food in the kitchen, but there was what appeared to be maybe $80, $90 million worth of Jackson Pollocks, Rothkos, and de Koonings hanging on the walls.
Was he brilliant at some level?
Well, yes, he was. Later, I found out what he was really brilliant at, which was lying. He had a physics degree, a mathematics degree, and an economics degree, I think from three different Ivy League colleges. So why doubt him, especially once you've seen the props? Once you've seen the art, you buy the person.
He's married to a successful woman named Sandy, who paid all the bills.
Yes.
How could this smart woman be with this fraud?
I can only answer that question by telling you why I bought this fraud.
Mm-hmm.
He was charming. He had a story that explained everything. And so when she came into his life, he had perfected his act to the extent that he'd anticipated every question, had an answer for everything. So it's like a magic trick. After you know how it works, it seems so obvious.
Yeah.
But when it's happening, you're enchanted.
In a moment when he gave you the personal phone number of the president.
Yeah.
And I forget what the occasion was, but he said, go ahead, try it. You'll get him directly.
Well, this was the strangest moment in my time with him. I'm staying at his mansion up in Cornish, New Hampshire, where J.D. Salinger lived. At one point, I complain that I've got some tax problems, that government's going to take a couple $1,000s out of my bank account for a tax bill. And he says, Walter, you can clear that up in a minute. Here, call George. And he writes a phone number down on a piece of paper. And then he said, Now, this is his private line. He'll pick up personally. It won't be a secretary. It was brilliant. He knew I'd never dial that number. I mean, the black helicopters would come down and, you know, scoop me out of my house if I dialed that phone number, I thought. I also thought, George Bush will get very mad at Clark Rockefeller for giving out his number, so I can't really dial it. But I put the number in my pocket and kept it there and walked around with it. You know, lies like that stun the mind. You don't question whether they're true or not because you could never imagine making one up yourself that's like it.
Yeah. And how did his story begin to unravel?
Well, by 2008, I was sick of him. It was always, don't call me, I'll call you. But we had bonded over the fact that we were both divorced and had kids that we didn't see as much as we wanted. In 2008, I turned on the internet, I think, and saw that there was a nationwide Amber Alert for Clark Rockefeller. He'd kidnapped his daughter from a custody hearing in Boston. And I thought, oh no, Clark did it. He snapped. He took his daughter. And even though I knew this was terrible, I kind of felt for him because for the last year he'd been on the phone to me, sort of crying on my shoulder about how much he missed her. Then a couple of days later, when he was captured, the Rockefeller family came out and said, he's not one of us. We don't know who this man is. And my response was, you cowards, you Rockefellers, throwing one of your own under the bus the minute there's a hint of scandal, you know. And I explained it by thinking, oh, maybe he's, you know, the bastard, unacknowledged child of one of them or something. Then a few days later, it came out that he was wanted in a gruesome, terrible murder dating back to 1985 in California. And as the details of the murder were described, a chill went through me and I realized it was all true. He was a fake, he was a kidnapper, and he was, in my mind, a murderer too. And I had been completely fooled.
Yeah. We should mention his real name, the name he got at birth.
Yeah, he wasn't even an American. He was Christian Karl Gerhardsreiter, a German who had come to the United States, to Connecticut, at 17. He'd watched a lot of American television, and he especially liked the show Gilligan's Island. And he had bonded with the character Thurston Howell III, the millionaire, and started imitating his voice and started developing a sort of upper-class American/British vocal manner. He literally was forming his act there.
Yeah. As it turned out, he'd adopted several poses before he settled on the Rockefeller one.
Yes.
Mr. Kern, why do you, in a couple of cases in this book, you refused to consider yourself a victim, which I understand, even though you were duped, mm-hmm. but you even call yourself a collaborator. Why?
Because the fact of the matter is that until he was convicted of these crimes, everyone believed him. I wanted to show the point of view of the dupe, of the fool. So I was hard on myself, but I collaborated with him in the sense that every time he told a story that didn't make sense, I tried to make it make sense for him in my mind. Every time he lied and I felt a little twinge inside, I covered it up. And I had to answer the question why I did that.
And?
Well, Clark answered it for me. When I saw him in jail after his murder conviction, I said, you're not going to admit to the murder, which he didn't. He had a story for that. Mm-hmm. But it's clear that you were a great con man, a great imposter for many years. What's the secret to fooling people? I said. And he looked at me and he said, Walter, three little words. I'm surprised you don't know. Vanity, vanity, vanity.
Walter Kern, his new book, Blood Will Out, The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Boy, Snow, Bird. This is the three-word title of Helen Oyeyemi's new novel. It's a version of the Snow White fairy tale told through the voices of three characters. Boy is the mother of a daughter named Bird, and the wicked stepmother of another named Snow. Snow is white. Bird is black. Like the fairy tale, Helen Oyeyemi's story is about beauty, envy, and identity. And like the fairy tale, mirrors are not to be trusted.
Nobody ever warned me about mirrors. So for many years I was fond of them and believed them to be trustworthy. I'd hide myself away inside them, setting two mirrors up to face each other so that when I stood between them, I was infinitely reflected in either direction. Many, many me's. When I stood on tiptoe, we all stood on tiptoe, trying to see the first of us and the last. The effect was dizzying, a vast pulse, not quite alive, more like the working of an automaton. I felt the reflection at my shoulder like a touch. I was on the most familiar terms with her, same as any other junior dope too lonely to be selective about the company she keeps.
When I was a kid, I loved doing that infinity thing with the mirrors. I can never get enough of that for some reason.
I didn't discover that for ages.
So this is set in mid-century Massachusetts. I'm sure you've been asked this question. You were British. You were born in Nigeria. What inspired you to set this book about race in 1950s New England?
Reading the fairy tale, the way that it's so explicit that Snow White's beauty is tied into the whiteness of her skin, there seemed a very clear connection to me with the 50s and 60s in America when there was very much a debate over the rights of a human being based on the color of their skin. And so it was very interesting to me to place this very white-seeming girl in the middle of that historical context.
And there's a way in which this book kind of takes apart the perversity of that obsession over skin tones. I don't want to give too much away, but passing is a major feature of this one family. We should explain this specifically. This means African-Americans who passed as white. Can you talk about that in this family, what it meant for them?
It meant a boost in their social standing. It meant this curious thing where in order to be yourself and to have people leave you alone, you need to pretend to be something else. Like there's a scene in the book where Olivia's talking about her love of opera and just being in the opera house and how she was quite sure that if people knew that she was black, they would look at her differently and wonder what she was doing there and what she was trying to be, when really she just loved opera. And it was a very sad thing that somebody could feel that they would have to go that far just to be able to enjoy the simple things that they like.
You mentioned Snow White, and of course there are a lot of resonances with fairy tales in this book. There's snow, of course, makes you think of Snow White, the fairest of them all. What fascinates you about fairy tales?
I think that the purest form of story that you can get, they sort of strip down human behavior to the absolute basics. So with Snow White, you have this story about envy and what the consequences of those are. And I suppose that when I'm reading a fairy tale, I find it easier to figure out how to rescue the characters than with other stories. And I wanted to rescue the wicked stepmother. I felt that, especially in Snow White, I think that the evil queen finds it a bit of a hassle to be such a villain. It seems a bit much of her, and so I kind of wanted to lift that load a little bit.
It's kind of funny, though, you're doing that in a novel, which is, it's not simple. It's complicated and overdetermined, people are messy.
Exactly. As you think it's going to be a quick job, like just dash in, rescue the wicked stepmother, everything will be fine, and things unfold.
The book deals with teenagehood in a really raw and direct way, the way we are inside the head of some of these characters. Is it wrong-headed to assume a sort of kinship? Because I know Bird makes sense of her world through writing. She talks about that. And I know, obviously, you had your first novel, I think, when you were 18. You've clearly been writing since you were young.
Yes. Well, in the kinship that I feel with Bird is more to do with her being a mimic, weirdly.
How do you mean?
She throws people's voices, and I think that I throw voices in my writing. I'm basically assembled of all the bits of writing and all the stories that I love, and I try and find ways to pull different things out of the box. And so, yeah, I'm a sort of literary mimic, and Bird is an auditory mimic.
You mentioned that your first novel came out when you were 18, and you've got a lot of attention for being so amazingly talented and being so young. Do you feel like that is that was like a burden to have to deal with? Do you feel like that's something you can kind of shed happily now? Or
no, I mean, now that I'm old, it's fine. And also, I think I was just born old, and I feel like I'm getting younger all the time, which is kind of fun for me, but will be confusing for others, for others possibly. I've become more. Perhaps I've realised I'm not serious as I thought that I was.
Well, so serious in what way? Because this book, I mean, there's a lot of humour in it, but it's not an unserious book.
This book has a lot of heavy things in it, but the people in it still manage to move through their lives without those weights on them quite so much. And I think that is an outlook that's coming to me as I get older.
Helen Oyeyemi's new book is called Boy, Snow, Bird. Helen, it was a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
That was lovely. Thank you.
We've all been there, wishing we could have more time to ourselves, more downtime. Washington Post journalist Bridget Schulte certainly has.
I felt like I was working all the time and yet never very good at what I was doing. I felt like I was trying to do everything for my kids. I felt all this pressure that I was a working mom, and so I was so guilty, and I didn't want to ruin their childhood. So I was up at 2 a.m. to bake cupcakes for the Valentine's party.
She was always stressed about something. Time for fun? Forget it. So Bridget consulted a sociologist who studies how people use their time. He insisted that Bridget just had to rethink her priorities and manage her emotions. The free time was there to find. 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there.
It's like he laid down the gauntlet. He said, come and do a time study with me and I will show you where your leisure is.
And how'd that go?
I gave him one of my weeks that I tracked, and he took out a yellow highlighter and he highlighted 27 hours of what he called leisure time, and I called bits and scraps of garbagey time.
Bridget Schulte writes about what she learned about herself, about motherhood and marriage, in a new book called Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. One thing she learned is that men and women approach time very differently. That was certainly the case for her and her husband, NPR correspondent Tom Bowman.
One of the best and first time studies that looked at men and women's time, the title is called Divergent Realities.
Mm-hmm.
It was so different. But for Tom and I, we had started off wanting to be equal partners. And it really took about 20 years. We had a very low moment where I thought, wow, we have really gotten off track. What happened?
Give me an example of a moment when you could tell, wow, we're off track.
Well, I opened the chapter with a story of a particularly bad Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
Where...
Set the scene for me. You are crazily cooking and preparing a meal for a lot of people.
We have 18 people coming over. The kitchen is covered with chopped vegetables and half-done side dishes, and we've got 3 hours before people arrive. The table's not set, and Tom comes over to the refrigerator, and I think he's going to put the turkey in, which is huge and raw. And, you know,
he's going to help out.
And he takes out a six pack and he says, a six pack of beer. And he says, OK, well, I'm going to go over to a friend's house and help him smoke his turkey. And my eyes just almost bugged out of my head. I said, basically, you're going to sit in the patio and watch the turkey get smoked and you're going to drink beer all afternoon while I'm doing all this work. And, you know, he sort of shrugged and walked out the door. And at that moment, I was filled with fury and rage, and it felt so unfair. But I was also really sad. And it took a while, but I realized that we had both fallen into very traditional roles without even realizing it, particularly when our first child was born.
These are the divergent realities that
we're
talking
about? Yeah, that's really when it diverges. And when you see a lot of these time studies, that's really the critical moment. We really don't have role models for what it means to be an egalitarian or an equal partnership.
What was your reality and what was Tom's as you came to realize it?
Well, one of the main differences is women are still doing so much of the housework and the childcare that there's physical labor that goes along with that, but there's also mental labor. You're keeping track of everything, you know, the to-do list, and did I remember the carpool, and oh my goodness, I got to fill out the Girl Scout forms, and, you know, all this stuff that kind of gets crowded in there along with all the stuff you got to do at work. And men generally don't have that. They have one sphere, which is work.
And it sounds like you reached a place where you really could sympathize. Talk about how you reached that place.
Well, it was really two things. It was really understanding this larger kind of water that we're all swimming in, that because we're on such a cutting edge of changing gender roles, our workplaces really haven't changed and haven't caught up with that reality. So workplaces, you know, if you look at surveys from around the globe, they think the best workers are the ones that come in early, that leave late, that are available 24/7, and our workplaces are becoming even more and more demanding. And we demand that most of men. That was the thing that was surprising, is really fascinating emerging social science that shows that men are more punished in the workplace if they try to be more involved at home, that they're seen as weird and wimps and weaklings. So it took me realizing that. It took us talking about, all right, well, what does it look like on a day-to-day basis to be equal? And I will tell you that this year for Thanksgiving was completely different. Tom had his jobs, I had mine, and at the end of the day, we all did the dishes and we all went to bed at the same time, and it was a lovely, lovely day.
And Bridget, you know, Tom is, as we've said, an NPR colleague here. I mean, was this tough for him to see this written? I mean, he's obviously okay with you coming in and talking about it.
We'd made an agreement that I would write what I felt was the truth. And I think what's important here is that we both learned through this process. And I think because of that, and because I realized that there are real things that men and women both need to look at, I think that that makes the story really more about redemption.
And also one of self-reflection. Bridget recalls one day when she was working on a front-page story at the Washington Post, the babysitter called to say she couldn't get Bridget's daughter to ballet lessons.
I immediately think, okay, I've got to take her to ballet. And I rush home and I get her and I throw a snack at her and I've got to get her dressed for ballet. And she's sort of sauntering about and I'm screaming at her and I'm driving like a maniac and I'm answering phone calls and I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to do all of this stuff all at the same time. But what did I teach her? I taught her she was entitled, and I taught her that to be a working mother was to live a crazy life. Whereas probably the better lesson was, sometimes things happen and things fall through. I have a job and it's important that I do it well, and you are important to me, but your ballet class does not trump the rest of life.
I wonder if, you know, looking back now, I mean, you've explored being a working mom. You've really explored the partnership with your husband. You've sort of looked at how you spend your time. How have you emerged from all this? In what way do you approach life differently?
Well, I'm still a work in progress. You know, there's a lot that I've learned. You know, we have made great progress in terms of who does what and what's fair at home. I don't feel the same mental clutter that I did before. And when it comes to leisure time, I do my to-do list differently now. I make time to step outside of what I'm doing. I make time for reflection, not as much as I'd like, but I'd never done that before. And to really think about, well, what do you want to make of your life here on this earth? And part of my priorities now are our time for reflection.
Thanks so much for coming in, Bridget. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Bridget Schulte. Her book, Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time, is out today. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Renee Monte.
A lot of talented jazz musicians in the 1930s couldn't buy a drink in the places they played. They were African-American musicians who created the music of their times but still had to live under the sting of segregation. Of course, unless they went somewhere else. Nicole Moniz has written a new novel in which a classically trained Baltimore pianist named Thomas Green is recruited to play jazz, music that's new to him, in a new place. Not Harlem, or the south side of Chicago, or even Paris, but Shanghai. He finds success, but then World War II begins to grip Shanghai and the world. Nicole Moniz' new novel is Night in Shanghai, and Nicole Moniz, who is the author of previous highly acclaimed novels, including A Cup of Light, joins us from the studios of NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Is Thomas Green real? Is he a composite? Is he apocryphal?
Well, of course, he's a fictional character. And the four main characters at the heart of this book, Thomas Green, the woman he falls in love with, Song Yuhua, mm-hmm. Lin Ming, his friend and Song's brother, and then David Epstein, his musical partner, during the last part of the book, after the nightlife is destroyed by the Japanese invasion. Of course, he's fictional, and these other three are fictional. But for me, part of the excitement of writing this book is that they are the only characters who are fictional. All the minor characters really lived, and all the events of the novel actually occurred.
So what did Thomas Green and other African-American musicians find in Shanghai they didn't at home?
They got the respect that they had always deserved, that they always knew they deserved. On the surface, there was playing for an equal wage, and that's a kind of freedom, to be able to play on an equal stage. But you know something? These jazz men did much more than just benefit from a well-deserved opportunity. They played a role in the city's modernization. Jazz was very modern. It was dissonant. It was syncopated. It was naughty. Even just to use lyrics about you and me and love, that went against the mores of the time. Yeah. It was the equivalent of almost talking dirty. So jazz left its stamp behind in broadened minds. And even more interesting, jazz was terrifying to the factions struggling for control of China from within China. Both the nationalists and the communists disapproved of jazz and feared it. They thought it would weaken people's resolve to fight off the invasion. And most Americans know, China did ban all Western music for about 30 years, starting in 1949. This is where it started.
This sounds altogether naive, but sometimes that can be the most serviceable question. How did the Japanese invasion change Shanghai and the scene you're talking about?
The Japanese invasion gave Japan complete control over the city, except for one area, and that was the concession, the colony, if you will, that was owned by Britain and America. The French concession. Frenchtown was an area that Japan could take complete control of, and they did, and it was the locus of nightlife. Mm-hmm. So they shut it down, they shut down the jazz clubs, and they replaced them with their own vice zone, the Badlands, which was largely devoted to gambling and also to purveying this new drug called heroin. This was not an environment conducive to serious music. And also, after the invasion, many of the African-American musicians left.
Hmm. Yeah, without, of course, giving away anything, it must be noted when, you know, by the time the novel ends, lives have been, to say the least, shaken, stirred, turned upside down. China's gone off on one path. The world has gone off on its own sad slide. Let's have a party, everyone. If I summarize that correctly.
You have absolutely nailed one of the reasons that during the very painful and in China frequently violent ramp up to World War II, people were completely involved in dancing the night away. Yeah. They wanted to dance to music that was exciting. They wanted to lose themselves in pleasure. And all of the industries that supported this, not just the ballrooms, which were all over the world, but the special feature of industries related to that that were next to it in Shanghai would include brothels and gambling halls and opium dens. Pleasure, release, escape, it extended so much further than just dance and jazz. But dancing and jazz was at the heart of it.
Nicole Moniz, her new novel, Night in Shanghai. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.